Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We are in the midst of a very important phase of that war, it seems, as things continue to unravel in Afghanistan, and we are obliged to pay closer attention than ever to why that is. And I think a short answer is because Pakistan is trying to engineer our defeat in Afghanistan, as it has been doing for some time. A man who has closely studied both Afghanistan and Pakistan and the region more generally, indeed who has served with great distinction in the United States Army Reserves in Afghanistan, is former combat veteran, colonel, and doctor Lawrence Sellin. He has been describing these topics for us for some time. He has written brilliantly about them elsewhere, including most recently yesterday at the Daily Caller. And it is always a pleasure to be able to catch up with him. Dr. Sellin, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we've been watching with growing concern, Lawrence, what is going on in and from Pakistan as it relates to the situation that, as I say, is becoming more dire by the day in Afghanistan. I'd like you to talk through with us quickly what Pakistan is up to, notably what it's doing with the Taliban, but also what it's doing with others like the Chinese and the Russians and the Iranians. Give us sort of an overview, if you would, of what this outfit is up to and what it means for us.
Yes, Frank. Pakistan has never wanted the United States in Afghanistan. Pakistan agreed to a number of demands that the United States made after 9/11. And they only did so because they thought they would get billions of dollars in aid, which they did, and also relieve the sanctions that the United States has placed upon Pakistan due to its nuclear activities. Now, the Pakistanis backed away from all those demands to which they agreed almost immediately and have been supporting and sustaining the Taliban and the Haqqani network inside Pakistan since the very beginning.
Yeah, and indeed, to some extent, even in Afghanistan as well, with arms as well as giving them safe haven from which to operate. And you have a fantastically interesting quote in your piece in the Daily Caller yesterday by the director at the time. This is 4 days after 9/11. General Mahmoud Ahmed ran the Pakistani intelligence service known as the ISI. You cite him as saying, "The United States enemies are our friends." That pretty much tells you everything you need to know, doesn't it, about the ISI as well as the Pakistani government more generally?
Well, yes. I think we need to acknowledge at this point, Frank, that Pakistan is not a friend of the United States. It's an ally of China. And in fact, Pakistan is operating right now with opponents of the United States like Iran. So the Pakistanis see their future with China and are making friends with Iran. In fact, the exports from Iran to Pakistan in the first 4 months of this year have increased by over 60%. And their military relationship between Pakistan and Iran has increased in the last year or so. So I think we can assume that going forward that we can't rely on the Pakistanis to be anything else than an ally of our enemies.
Yeah, including among them Russia as well. As you point out, in July there was a conference among the intelligence leaders of Pakistan's ISI and China, Russia, and Iran. That's a pretty unsavory company, needless to say. This other quote that I wanted just to pull in was Lieutenant General Hamid Gul, another ISI director in 2015, discussing how the ISI was going to drive the United States out of Afghanistan with the help of the United States, to uproarious laughter from his audience. Again, ominous signs of where their loyalties lie. I wanted to turn finally with you, Dr. Lawrence Sellin, to Imran Awan. I know you've been following his capers here in the United States for some time. We're going to be speaking in the next segment with Luke Rosiak, who has joined you at the Daily Caller in describing what these fellows from Pakistan, led by Imran Awan, have been up to inside the IT systems of many members of the House Democratic Caucus. But knowing what you know about the intelligence services of Pakistan, Lawrence, were this chap, Awan, to be an asset of the ISI, do you think it's possible that he could have been doing considerable damage, espionage and other intelligence collection, who knows, blackmail or other influence operations from the vantage point of this IT server ring on Capitol Hill?
Well, I believe so. Long before this story of Imran Awan broke, there was another report that said that the Pakistani intelligence was trying to infiltrate the Indian parliament with IT people. So what has happened in terms of Imran Awan is consistent with Pakistani intelligence operations. And furthermore, the Pakistani intelligence is well known to hire both shady and even criminals to conduct their operations. So I firmly believe that Imran Awan was part of a Pakistani intelligence operation to do what you described, to gather information about the United States and even information to blackmail members of the U.S. government.
Yeah. And again, as a man who has served in the uniform of the United States and knows a lot about these things, in terms of the kind of information that might have been obtained from congressional servers, even if it wasn't classified necessarily, do you think that in your professional judgment, Colonel, that this kind of access could have translated into real benefit, perhaps not just to Pakistan's intelligence services, but others with whom they're collaborating to the detriment of the United States?
Well, I think certainly that's true. I think it's very likely that the information that was gathered by Imran Awan has been transmitted to Chinese intelligence. And if not only Chinese, it could be Iranian as well. So it's at this point, it's hard to predict how far and wide the information that Imran Awan gathered has been transmitted to our enemies.
And to what end? To what effect? This is one of the things that we will be exploring closely with Luke Rosiak, who has done extraordinary reporting on the subject. But we appreciate your context, as well as the analysis and reporting you yourself are doing, Dr. Lawrence Sellin, both of you on the pages of the Daily Caller. It's a tremendous resource for the rest of us, and we appreciate your visiting with us from time to time to discuss it. I hope you'll do so again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for your service to our country in uniform, as well as that you're rendering these days. Come back to us again very soon. Luke Rosiak is next with the latest in the Imran Awan scandal, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Luke Rosiak, a man who, to my way of thinking, if there were any justice in the world, would be a Pulitzer Prize winner for the extraordinary investigative reporting that he has been doing at the Daily Caller news service. He has been incredibly assiduous and intrepid and tenacious, in particular, in exposing the facts concerning this so-called House IT scandal, the evident reliance by dozens of members of the House Democratic Caucus for quite a protracted period on Pakistani nationals led by this fellow we spoke of a moment ago with Dr. Lawrence Sellin, Imran Awan. And we wanted to catch up with Luke to take stock both of the backstory here, what we know about Imran Awan, and then to cover a bit of the scandal of what has just been done in the way of, a miscarriage of justice with respect to this individual and his operation. Luke Rosiak, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back.
Thank you, Frank.
So let's begin with just a little bit of a 101 course on what you have found in the course of your investigations about this chap, Imran Awan. What do we know about him and his family, as well as what he was doing in the House of Representatives for, as I say, scores, actually, of members of the Democratic caucus there?
Well, he was a systems administrator for a fifth of the congressional Democrats, including a lot of members of the Intelligence Committee, Homeland Security Committee, et cetera, as well as, you know, heads of the DNC, Wasserman Schultz and other influential Democrats. And the inspector general found shortly before the 2016 election that he was funneling data off the network and making access to all kinds of servers that he shouldn't have been, logging in as members of Congress personally and kind of taking evasive measures to cover his tracks. And they kind of didn't ban him until they didn't do anything until after the election. They kind of just punted and stalled. We're very vague about the whole thing. But when I started looking into it more, I saw that there was just a whole lot going on here. For one, he had a secret email address that was a backdoor into the House network, even after he was eventually banned, because he stole the identity of Andre Carson's intelligence staffer. And he had this email address called 123@mail.house.gov that was hidden under the name of this intelligence guy. And then, you know, he's basically was sending money over to Pakistan. His wife fled the country with $12,000 in a suitcase. He was arrested at the airport with $9,000 in a suitcase. And you look into this background, he actually had two wives, one of whom was his first cousin. And she, you know, basically they got married right after he got citizenship. And she then, of course, got citizenship and joined the payroll of Debbie Wasserman Schultz. He had another wife. Both of these wives filed police reports against him saying he was wiretapping them. One of them said she was, basically he had four women actually in all who said he was either wiretapping, extorting, threatening to kidnap, threatening their lives, holding them in captivity, keeping them like slaves, just astonishing stuff. And worst of all is that the Democrats wouldn't say anything bad about this guy. And here you have this guy who's like the cardinal, violating all their cardinal rules about like don't abuse women, you know, don't hack politicians. And then obviously that raised the specter of, you know, sort of blackmail.
Yeah. So, have they been compromised, I guess is the question.
Exactly. Why else would they be not speaking out against this guy, and why would they be kind of treating him with kid gloves?
Not only not speaking out against him, not only not, you know, treating him more, well, forthrightly, shall we say, but not pressing charges against him for what he and his family members, five or six of them, as I recall, were doing inside their emails, inside their official correspondence, inside their information loops with the committees on which they serve. And you mentioned Andre Carson. Andre Carson is a man who's got a very checkered background in his own right, but nonetheless is a member of the House Intelligence Committee, for heaven's sake. So these are sensitive conversations, I think it's fair to say. And it raises a question, Luke, that I want to come back to in a moment, as to who may have had access to this information as a result. But before we leave the saga of Imran Awan and his being held accountable for all of this, you have pointed out on this program, and of course in your terrific reporting at the Daily Caller, that the House Republican leadership has been nowhere to be seen on this saga at all. In fact, complicit in a cover-up of it, have they not?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Paul Ryan has made some, you know, completely nonsensical statements about the way that he's handled this. Here you had the IG saying data was flying off the network and they didn't do anything. And for months and months and months, it makes no sense. The hilarious thing is that, so Imran Awan was, despite all the evidence, despite server logs, despite also separate evidence of a theft scheme that he was engaged in the house, they only charged him with bank fraud involving his efforts to flee the country and wire a bunch of money over to Pakistan.
So this is the DOJ basically taking a dive on this as well as all of these other characters.
I think it comes down to probably they didn't sense any mandate from Paul Ryan. So that's probably what led to what happened in court yesterday. But what happened in court was, you know, he got a slap on the wrist because it was bank fraud anyway. So he weren't really expecting him to face any real jail time or anything. But they went in there and he's got this Clinton defense attorney and former aide Hillary Clinton, now is his defense attorney. And their argument for basically that sentencing was that Donald Trump is, quote, pathetic, deranged, that Republicans like Charles Grassley and Louie Gohmert are without a shred of decency. This really just a personal vitriolic attack on a lot of preeminent Republicans. And the judge, who was an Obama-appointed judge, was so receptive to this line of argument that she said, you know what? No further punishment needed. You've suffered enough at the hands of the government.
No, wait a minute. Say that again. What did she say?
The judge said, you've suffered enough at the hands of the highest levels of government. And so what she meant is, Republicans did oversight in this case, so you don't need to be punished. And Imran Awan actually stood up in front of the court and cried and said, I want to thank the Department of Justice and the FBI. So this is an interesting distinction to me between you've got kind of competent oversight people who are concerned about the rule of law, and they are being excoriated in court. But then contrast that with Jeff Sessions is being lauded by a criminal defendant for looking the other way at all the voluminous evidence.
And just so we're all clear here, folks, when Luke Rosiak talks about voluminous evidence, check out his extraordinary and extensive reporting on this subject. It is fair to say that the evidence is compelling, overwhelming, and the ignoring of it at all these levels is nothing short of a travesty. I did want to come back to one point that was occurring to me a moment ago as you were talking about bank fraud and the judge holding that this very dubious character, Imran Awan, has suffered enough. This ruling came down, of course, at the same time that Paul Manafort was being excoriated and presumably being set up for a lot of hard time in federal penitentiary for bank fraud, among some other, you know, misconduct, to be sure, but for bank fraud, for heaven's sakes. This is bizarre. And when we turn to the next piece of this, Luke, which I just would like to explore with you a little bit, in the previous segment with Colonel Lawrence Sellin, we talked a bit about the Pakistani Intelligence Service, ISI. And I know in your reporting, you've raised the question as to whether or not these Pakistani nationals, particularly Imran Awan, who made much of his relationship with the government of Pakistan, were in fact working for, either as agents of or simply helpers to, the Pakistani ISI. Colonel Sellin has talked about how hostile that operation is to us and how beneficial it would be to have agents working for them or collecting intelligence on Capitol Hill for them. What's your current read on whether that is something that may be in the mix here too? And we certainly know the Pakistani intelligence services have been on Capitol Hill in the past. Do you think that's what was going on here in this instance too?
Well, there are reasons to be concerned. One of them is that Imran Awan, he spends months out of every year in Pakistan, and he travels there with an armed entourage of government agents there. And then he also has a business partner in Pakistan who told me on the record, alleges that basically the Awans were giving USBs of data to Pakistani intel.
USBs, of course, being those thumb drives that can pack a lot of information, classified and otherwise.
Right. And of course, that kind of thing would explain the entourage that he travels with. as well as there's a Pakistani article back from 2009 in a Pakistani newspaper that talks about how he was involved in some fraud over there involving a major real estate development that he was trying to profit off of. And suddenly major influence came down from the U.S. government and all this, you know, the Pakistani government as well. And this guy seemed to have inordinate sway over the Pakistani local government. Well, how does that come to be? I mean, obviously some relationship there could explain that. However, personally, my theory is that this is a guy that's primarily motivated by money. My primary concern is blackmail of members of Congress by using their data. But there is, he's an equal opportunity. He's sort of a freelancer. I think that he is a guy with an inordinate quest for hunger, for thirst for money. Money. He would do anything for money. And so he would certainly be willing to sell some of this data to, I think, parties, perhaps including kind of what you're talking about.
Pakistan intelligence. It certainly would not be the first time that an intelligence service compensated someone for the intelligence that they collected. And when we talk about intelligence, of course, look, this is not to say that there's necessarily classified information that he had access to, but there's a lot of sensitive information just in terms of individuals' emails. And of course, the specter and the conduct of these House Democrats suggesting that they may well have been subjected to coercive or blackmail sorts of threats is something that we really need an investigation of. You've come the closest to conducting that, and I commend you for it. And we'll look forward to your continuing reporting on this subject. Luke Roziak of The Daily Caller, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is a delight to say we are joined once again by a man I've admired for a long time and have talked to from time to time, but not in a while. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. He has been extraordinarily important in a variety of capacities over a long period of time, starting with his service to our country in the uniform of the United States Army. He has also been an assistant attorney general for the state of Washington. He's been a retired operations officer, having served for some 20 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, rising to be the chief of the CIA's Weapons of Mass Destruction Terrorism Unit. Hard to imagine a more important post. He has run for Congress from Maryland's 5th Congressional District. These days, he is a senior partner with Artemis LLC. And before we're done, we'll talk a little bit about some of his writings and other contributions to the public policy debate, particularly about matters involving security, which is our topic today. Sam Faddis, welcome back. It is so good to have you.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be talking to you again.
Good. Well, let's make this more frequent from now on. But I have been musing about the John Brennan caper, the decision by President Trump to revoke his security clearances, and the kind of prism that that controversy affords us to have a serious and, it seems to me, long overdue conversation about security more broadly. Security being, of course, the first word in security clearance. I've kind of come up with the phrase, sort of a riff off of the president's Make America Great Again, Make America Safe Again. How about making security secure again? Let's talk a little bit about your insights as a former CIA hand about John Brennan.
I agree with you that this is a conversation we need to have, and it is long overdue. I mean, Mr. Brennan can say whatever he wants. Obviously, he's an American citizen. I don't challenge him on that. I have no idea on earth why he still had a security clearance or why he believes he should have a right to a security clearance. And I fully support the president's decision to take it away.
Well, let me back the lens up a little bit here, because I just would like to get your thoughts as a guy who obviously was subjected to a lot of background investigations and polygraphs and, you know, investigations of your character and your associations and your judgment. How do you think John Brennan got a clearance in the first place? I guess is the question I'd like to ask. The guy voted for a communist as president of the United States in 1976. And as Andrew Bostom has pointed out in a master's thesis, which would have been available to any competent investigator, you know, he's endorsing really authoritarianism of the communist stripe, or for that matter, of the Islamist stripe. Wouldn't that, under normal circumstances, have been considered disqualification?
Yeah, well, quite likely so. I mean, I think it raises a really good point that you and I have touched on before, which is, I think our entire security apparatus in the sense of security background checks is really broken. Like a lot of things in Washington, it's just turned into this pro forma box checking exercise, which pays no attention to things that, like the things that you've just highlighted, that are very, very serious, and then spends a lot of time doing other silly things. I've come home from overseas assignments when it was time for me to be reinvestigated. You know, I'm living in a temporary house for 90 days in between posts going back overseas, and watched the guy doing the security background check on me come every night and try to talk to my neighbors next door when I've been in the house for 10 days and I've never actually spoken to the guy next door. I've literally had to go outside and speak to them and say, "Hey, guy, I just spent 8 years straight overseas and in 75 days I'm going back out and I don't even know that guy's name. So why are you talking to him?" There are people all over the world who have been in harm's way with me for years who could probably tell you all kinds of things about me, but you're not talking to any of them. You just got your little checklist. Talk to the neighbors. It's that kind of silliness.
Right. So let me ask you, as you've, again, been subjected to these kinds of scrutiny in the past, when you hear, as the Department of Treasury put out in a report back in May of this year, that an organization called the U.S. Investigative Service, a private company that was enlisted to do background investigations starting in the Clinton administration, well, I think the technical term for it was flushed 660,000 background investigations and simply told the agencies for whom they were doing the investigations that they'd done them. They weren't even checking the boxes. I mean, they were just pretending that they'd gone through the whole exercise. And interestingly enough, Sam, and I'm not asking you to comment specifically on this this report, but the data is just shocking that there were something like 2,600 people that the Treasury Department found just looking at one sort of small subset of this larger problem at the IRS, that 2,600 people had been brought on staff with security clearances who had not had background investigations done, and all but four of them, according to this analysis, were considered to be moderate to critical security risks. Many of them were still on the payroll as of the time this study was done, I think in 2017. I just wonder, going to your point about the system being broken, how serious a problem is this if we've been giving clearances out to people who shouldn't have them and are perhaps even critical security risks?
Yeah, well, I think it's a massive problem and it's symptomatic of what we both know, which is that Washington as a whole is very broken, broken beyond the comprehension of virtually all Americans. And at the same time, by the way, that they've got thousands of people that they haven't bothered to do a background check on at all, or have done ridiculously silly, superficial checks on, they are periodically jacking people up over things that are completely nonsensical and make, you know, or for that matter, even worse than that, jacking people up over things that are clearly political considerations that have nothing to do, that have nothing to do with any true security risk. And this is just symptomatic of what we know. We have a bureaucracy that is just completely dysfunctional and broken. And we have just begun the process. We're just barely dipping our toes into the process of regaining control over this thing.
I had one of your colleagues, Brad Johnson, on the show yesterday, another former clandestine service officer who was also, like you, a chief of station during his distinguished career. And one of the things that he was very agitated, I think it's fair to say, about concerning John Brennan's time as the Central Intelligence Agency director was not just the lying and to Congress and the participation in the Benghazi cover-up scandal and his sort of free pass both in that job and as the Homeland Security Advisor to the president, to the Muslim Brotherhood, but specifically what he did to the Human Intelligence activities and service of the Central Intelligence Agency. Would you care to comment on that from your experience?
Yeah, I mean, John Brennan, obviously, by virtue of his background, doesn't actually know anything at all about human intelligence operations. So you have put a guy in charge of an organization that only exists to do that, who actually knows nothing about the trade. And what does he spend his time doing as director? You know, playing with lines on wiring diagrams, messing with moving offices around at headquarters. This is the last guy on the planet you should have running an organization like that. And this takes us to a broader issue, which is that as many great people as we have at CIA, we have a lot. We do not have an organization performing anywhere near the level it should perform.
That we need it to perform at.
I mean, I'm obviously biased, but I cannot think of an organization in our national security apparatus that is more important than the CIA, particularly in the kind of war we are engaged in the shadows all over the planet. We can't have except sort of C+, B- level performance. It's got to get better. Brennan's gone. I'm not sure we've turned the corner on that process at the agency.
Yeah. Well, and that brings me to a last point. The living legacy of John Brennan at the Central Intelligence Agency is presumably the personnel that he mentored and promoted and has now turned the agency over to, in effect. I'm thinking specifically of Gina Haspel, the Central Intelligence Agency director, and her deputy, Vaughn Bishop. Haspel, of course, having come out of the DO, the Directorate of Operations, as you did, and the Deputy Bishop having come out of the analysis side of the house. Any thoughts on whether that might be a problem, that they are Brennan protégés?
Well, let me say this about Gina, with whom I have never had a harsh word in my life. She represents the status quo. If you are expecting change, improvement, innovation, you're going to be sorely disappointed. What she represents is we're just going to hold whatever course we've been on.
And if the course has been charted by John Brennan to turn the agency, to some degree at least, into an instrument of political warfare, and I think that's fair, certainly what we've seen of its activity under him vis-a-vis the Trump campaign and the early post-election period suggests that, not changing course would mean that would likely continue. Is that a fair inference from what you've said?
I think that's an absolutely fair inference. And we could go back. I mean, we could go back at least as far as like Morrell and Benghazi, right, for the agency being made part of this political warfare. She is not going to fix that.
Yeah. Deeply troubling stuff, my friend. And the fact that it comes from somebody with your extraordinary background in the Central Intelligence Agency, in the covert side of the house, and that you obviously are still very closely following what's going on inside that important organization, I couldn't agree with you more. It is probably never been more important for us to have human intelligence than at a time when so many of the hard targets that we're working against, if we're able to operate against them at all, requires that kind of insight that you don't get through, you know, the so-called technical means of collection. Sam, again, thank you for your time today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Kevin Freeman, one of the country's preeminent authorities about and most brilliant authors and essayists concerning economic warfare. Economic warfare is, of course, the topic of his two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. It's also the focus of his new television program, Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, and his blog, globaleconomicwarfare.com. Kevin Freeman, it's so good to have you back. There is a lot to talk about. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
In particular, I think it's now evident to just about everybody that Economic warfare is what Communist China has been waging against the United States for quite some time. You and I discussed this most weeks, but we're in the midst now of high-level conversations between the United States government, which is finally fighting back in this domain a bit, and the Chinese. Where do you think that stands at the moment? More tariffs seem to be in the offing, but is there any sign that there's going to be a ceasefire, let alone, you know, an end to this kind of warfare by the Chinese against us?
Well, first, let me acknowledge the great awakening of the United States government. It's been about a decade that I've been traveling to Washington and pointing out, you know, they're stealing from us intellectual property, they're manipulating the currency, they're doing attacking the dollar, they're inside our stock market and working inside our stock market, you know, listing all these things. And finally, we have an administration that's paying attention, and not only paying attention, but insistent that they cease these activities and that we return to our position in the world.
I give you a lot of credit for that, Kevin Freeman. You have been doing incredible spade work, not just here in Washington, but of course with your books and your countless interviews and our conversations, I like to think here. But let's be honest, I think it took Donald Trump, a man who got all of this and who learned from you for sure, but also has had a lot of hard experience of his own, to turn this into actual policy. And it's very gratifying to me, and I'm sure it is to you as well.
Oh, absolutely. And they're making the moves because we're in a stronger position. We import quite a bit from the Chinese, and we export very little to them. And what we export to them are, you know, mostly animal products and soybeans and things like that. They're not buying finished goods from the United States. They're not buying much other than those things. And so they're in a much weaker position than we are, and the Trump administration's recognized it, and they're taking advantage of it. They have not capitulated on the Chinese side yet. They are continuing to do everything that they can to not give in. They're continuing all of their influence operations, are continuing everything they're doing. And in fact, it's weakening their economy, but their response has been to ratchet up even more debt. They've gone back to their old playbook of balance sheet loans through municipalities, doing infrastructure projects, doing the sorts of things that they've done to build their economy internally, and yet it's putting them in a worse position economically.
Yeah. Does this likely give rise, Kevin Freeman, the lending that they're doing through their government entities as well as through the banking system, which is obviously very much under the sway of the government as well, through, you know, the decline of their currency? Are we seeing essentially conditions for an unraveling of the Chinese economy looming?
Well, you know, that is something that's almost inconceivable to the average person. But our friend Gordon Chang has talked about how weak internally their economy really is, and how they prop it up with smoke and mirrors and debt and all sorts of things. So there is that all of a sudden the Chinese economic miracle unravels possibility. I wouldn't put it as a high probability at this point, but it's becoming more and more likely. And if they continue on this path, our economy is growing. Our retail sales are good. You know, unemployment is down. Everything in the United States seems to be working fairly well. That's the same is not true in China at this point, and they're doing everything desperately that they can to keep things propped up. But they can't last at this pace for too terribly long.
One other contributing factor, I guess, is that they are extending themselves even further overseas. We've talked about their Belt and Road Initiative and the immense lending that they're doing in connection with infrastructure development that has a debt trap quality to it, a very interesting and ominous strategic play. One of the countries in which, according to our friend David Goldman, we're seeing this play out with very problematic implications, both for the country in question and for us as well, is in Turkey. What is China up to there, Kevin? And again, what might the strategic implications of it be?
Well, Turkey is obviously a very strategic location just from where it sits between Europe and the Middle East. Turkey is a part of NATO. Turkey has a long history of association with the West and so forth. So it is an entree door into Europe. It's an entree door into NATO. And so there's no question why the Chinese would be interested there. And at the same time, Erdogan has taken his nation away from the Western values that had been adopted and is really turning it into an internal dictatorship. And they've sided against, you know, against our allies and with our enemies in so many cases. So we're watching the world split, and it's not unlike the Cold War or the Axis and the Allies. We're watching the world divide, and China is going after any pressure point that they might think that they could take advantage of, anything that they could use to pressure us. They're building their alliances, and we're building our alliances. Right now, it's an economic war. They're aware of it. They're taking advantage of it. And fortunately, President Trump and his team, John Bolton and others, they're also aware, and we're responding in kind. But there's no doubt in my mind that they're strategically looking to influence Turkey because they realize it's a pathway to Europe and a pathway against the United States.
Yeah. I don't know if you'd go so far as David has, but his conclusion is with essentially the unraveling of the Turkish economy, partly thanks to the sanctions that President Trump has imposed, partly due to its own misconduct in the financial and economic realms, that the Chinese may wind up essentially wholly owning Turkey, its ports, its airfields, its businesses, and the like. Do you think that's in prospect? And again, can that possibly be sustainable for the Chinese if they were to try?
Well, with the trajectory of the Turkish economy and the collapse that they're seeing, having adopted dictatorial socialist style policies, you know, controlling policies, no individual liberties and so forth that allow a country to grow and prosper, it might be similar to wind up owning the boulder tied around your neck like Venezuela. So it could be very detrimental. Now, there are huge strategic assets there, and we don't want the Chinese to have them, but it's only going to add to their debt problems. It's only going to burden them if they do go down that route. China is not, and it would probably lead to a shooting war at some point, because China won't go quietly if they go down.
Yeah. Well, that's a cheery thought. We will be turning to that again, I know, with you, Kevin, among others. Let me turn to one other topic. The Russian government, of course, has also begun to feel the pinch of U.S. sanctions, and its economy seems to be hitting some rough patches as well. Talk a little bit about the latest round of sanctions that have involved, as I understand it, a seizure of assets here in the United States, Kevin.
Well, we've been on a path of seizing Russian assets since the Ukrainian invasion that they undertook. But these sanctions are being ratcheted up. This is not a government that is in collusion with Russia in any way. It's obvious for anyone who's objective and looks at it. They're actually being pretty hard on Putin and Russia. And Russia's retaliating, and Russia is dumping their treasury assets and buying gold, and they're telling everybody else that they know to get out of the dollar. So we're witnessing economic warfare continue between Russia and the United States. Seizing of when you have a crony economy like Putin's arranged, one of the ways that you attack them is you seize the assets of his friends, and we've been doing that for several years, and it looks like it's being ratcheted up.
Fascinating. Kevin, as always, your insights into these issues are so important. Kevin Freeman, thanks for what you do at Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman, of course, as a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy. I commend you all once more, his books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan. Kevin, we'll talk with you again next week. Hope to talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.